Here it is, VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear from Katie Weaver and Brian Lynn. John Russell has a new Everyday Grammar report. We close the show with the next part of The Making of a Nation. But first, Katie Weaver brings us a report on the death of Queen Elizabeth II.
British officials in London announced that Elizabeth II, Queen of England, has died at the age of 96. Elizabeth reigned for more than 70 years and became Britain's longest-serving monarch. Officials at the headquarters of the British royal family said Elizabeth died at her summer home of Balmoral Castle in Scotland. Members of the royal family had hurried to be with her after her health appeared to worsen. Her son, 73-year-old Prince Charles, will now become king. It is unclear whether he will reign as King Charles III or under another name. The effects of her death may not be fully known for years. She helped strengthen the British monarchy and was respected by the British public and world leaders. Most Britons have never known another monarch. Elizabeth became queen on February 6, 1952. During her reign, her country rebuilt after the destruction of World War II. Elizabeth served with 15 British prime ministers, starting with Winston Churchill. That line extended all the way to September 6th, when she accepted the resignation of Boris Johnson and welcomed Liz Truss as the country's new prime minister. In Britain's constitutional monarchy, the prime minister serves as the head of government, while the monarch serves as head of state. 5 years before she became queen, a 21-year-old Elizabeth promised the people of Britain, "My whole life, whether it be long or short, shall be devoted to your service." For most of her life, Elizabeth served as the public face of the British monarchy and of the British people. She represented Britain's last link to the World War II generation and its many sacrifices. She was born Elizabeth Alexandra Mary Windsor in London on April 21, 1926. She was the first child of the Duke and Duchess of York and was not expected to be queen. But her father's older brother, who became King Edward VIII, abdicated the throne in 1936, and Elizabeth's father became George VI. She was a teenager when Britain went to war with Germany. She spent much of the war living near London, at Windsor Castle. When the war in Europe ended, she said she celebrated with the crowds in London. She described the day as "one of the most memorable nights of my life." In 1947, she married Royal Navy officer Philip Mountbatten, a prince of Greece and Denmark. The first of their four children, Prince Charles, was born in 1948, followed by Princess Anne in 1950, Prince Andrew in 1960, and Prince Edward in 1964. While visiting Kenya in 1952, Elizabeth was told that her father had died and that she was queen. Over the long years of her reign, she led the royal family through good times and bad. The marriage of son Charles to Lady Diana Spencer in 1981 was televised around the world. But the Queen called 1992 a terrible year when her daughter divorced, Charles separated from Diana, and Andrew separated from his wife, too. In 1997, Diana was killed in a car accident in France. Elizabeth's reaction to the tragedy left her somewhat less popular worldwide. But the Queen, from her earlier years to old age, continued to present a public image of bravery and common sense. Elizabeth spoke to her nation in April 2020 as people were being kept apart by COVID-19 health restrictions. She offered hope of better times ahead. We should take comfort that while we may have more still to endure, better days shall return. We will meet again, she said. I'm Katie Weaver.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken made an unannounced visit to Kyiv Thursday. He offered $2.2 billion in new military aid to Ukraine and other European countries threatened by Russia. During his visit, Blinken held talks with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and other officials. Blinken said in a statement that the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden had informed Congress of its plans to provide $2.2 billion in long-term military financing. U.S. officials said about $1 billion of the aid will go to Ukraine. The rest will be divided among 18 of its neighbors, including NATO military alliance members and area security partners. The aid will provide loans to countries to permit them to buy weapons and defense equipment made in the U.S. The countries receiving aid remain potentially at risk of future Russian aggression, Blinken said in a statement. President Joe Biden has been clear, we will support the people of Ukraine for as long as it takes. It was Blinken's second visit to the Ukrainian capital since Russia invaded the country in February. White House officials said Biden also spoke by phone with U.S. allies and partners to underscore our continued support for Ukraine as it defends itself from Russian aggression. The new military aid is in addition to a separate deal worth $675 million announced earlier Thursday by U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin during a visit to Ramstein, Germany. That aid covers heavy weapons, ammunition, and military vehicles for Ukraine alone. Zelensky said Ukraine was thankful for America's enormous support, which he said was helping Ukraine return our territory and lands. I'm Brian Lynn.
News reports and everyday discussions increasingly involve the term attention, as in the attention economy. The idea that human attention is a limited resource. If you wanted to talk about attention, How would you do so? What terms and structures would you use? In today's report, we will explore the noun, attention, and some terms that connect to it. You will learn about the most common ways Americans talk about attention. The Online Etymology Dictionary describes the history and meaning of many words. It suggests that the noun attention dates to the late 1300s, with the meaning of active direction of the mind upon some object or topic. The Online Etymology Dictionary also suggests that the term is used with a remarkable diversity of verbs. One of the most commonly used verbs with the noun attention is pay. You might link the verb pay with money. You pay money for something. For example, you could say, I paid $100 for this phone. But in modern times, the most common kind of paying, Google's Ngram suggests, is with attention. The most common way this structure appears is as this, pay attention to. Google's Ngram shows pay attention to becoming more common during the 1980s. That growth has continued up to the present, or at least up to 2019, the latest year included in the data. This change suggests an increasing concern about attention. Here are a few ways you might hear Americans use pay attention to. A daily reader of news or social media might say,
I pay attention to the news.
Or,
I pay attention to trends on social media.
In the negative form, a person might use the auxiliary verb do, as in,
I don't pay attention to social media.
In the case of regret, a person might use the modal should, as in,
I should have paid attention to my parents.
But we do not only pay attention. We can also draw attention, meaning to cause attention to be given to someone or something. Google's Ngram suggests that the structure draw attention has become more common in recent years. And while English speakers might use the verb draw with other nouns, the most common use of the verb draw is with attention. For example, a teacher might say, I would like to draw your attention to the image on page 37. Sometimes Americans use modifiers before the noun attention. For example, a person might say,
That social media post drew a lot of attention.
In this case, a lot of appears in between the main verb, draw, and the noun, attention. We also use attention with several other verbs, attract, receive, deserve, get, and give. There are differences in the way these terms are used. Receive attention describes a fact. For example, a person might say that an event received a lot of attention. Or, a person might say that the event received very little attention. Other structures make a claim about value. The structure deserves attention, for example, could suggest that something has not been the subject of attention, but it should be. For example, a person might say,
This problem deserves attention.
Or,
This issue deserves more attention.
An important idea related to attention is the verb and noun focus. The verb form of focus means to direct your attention or effort at something. As with other structures that use the noun attention, focus has become more common over the past 30 years, Google's Ngram suggests. pay attention to, and focus have very similar meanings. But in everyday situations, we sometimes use them in slightly different ways. Still, if you use one in place of the other, your meaning will probably be understood. Let's end this report with a chance to use the ideas described today. Write a short response to one of the following questions.
1. What do you pay attention to? Why do you pay attention to it? 2. What should people pay attention to? Why should people pay attention to it?
Write us in the comments section of our website. Write us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. I'm John Russell.
Today on The Making of a Nation, we look at the history of early American Indians. Here is Steve Ember.
The native peoples of North and South America came from Siberia thousands of years ago. There was a land bridge between Siberia and Alaska before the end of the last ice age. As the groups settled different parts of the land, they developed their own cultures and religions. Each group's story is important in the history of the Americas. But our story today will focus on the tribes in what became the central part of the United States. In 1804, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark led a group of explorers to the Pacific Ocean. They met the tribes of the Great Plains. The explorers were perhaps the first white people these Native Americans had ever seen. When the group of explorers neared the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains, they encountered the Shoshone tribe. Meriwether Lewis was the first to see them. Imagine for a moment that we are with Meriwether Lewis near the Rocky Mountains. Across a small hill, a group of 60 Shoshone men are riding toward us. The first thing we see is that these men are ready for war. Each is armed with a bow and arrow. Some carry long poles with a sharp knife at the end. They are riding very fast. Some of the horses look like they do not have riders. But as they get closer, we see that the riders are hanging off the sides of the horses or under the neck. They are using the horses' bodies for protection. The horses are painted with many different designs in blue, black, red, and other colors. Later, we learn that each design has a special meaning for the man who owns the horse. Each one tells a story. For example, the rider of one of the horses is a leader in battle. Another has killed an enemy. As they come nearer, the Shoshone group sees that we are not ready for war. They slow their horses, but are still very careful. Meriwether Lewis holds up an open hand as a sign of peace. The leader of the Shoshone does the same. They come closer. The Shoshone are dressed in clothes made from animal skins. Most of these skins are from deer or buffalo. The skins also have designs and tell stories like the designs on the horses. One design shows that someone has fought in a battle. Another shows that the person has been in many raids to capture horses. Still another shows that someone saved the life of a friend. Meriwether Lewis smiles at these men. He and the Shoshone chief cannot speak each other's language. The explorer again makes a sign of peace, and the sign is again returned. One young Shoshone comes near. He gets off his horse. He is tall and looks strong. His hair is long and black. He wears one long bird feather in the back of his hair. His arms have been painted with long lines. We learn that each line represents a battle. There are many lines on his arms. Fortunately, we are able to continue our travels without a need for him to add another line. Many tribes, including the Shoshone, populated the area known as the Great Plains. The land they lived on influenced the lives and cultures of these Indian nations. The plains stretch across the central part of the country and north into Canada and south to Mexico. Even in a car traveling at 100 kilometers an hour, it can take 2 long days of driving to cross the Great Plains. In the east, the plains begin near the Mississippi River and go west to the huge Rocky Mountains. There are big rivers here and deserts. Some areas are so flat that a person can see for hundreds of kilometers. Huge areas of this land were once covered by thick grasses. Those grasses provided food for an animal that made possible the culture of the Indians of the Great Plains. The grass fed the buffalo or bison that were the center of native culture in the Great Plains. The huge animals provided meat for the Indians and much more. They were an important part of the religion of most of the native people of the Great Plains. The Lakota tribe, sometimes called the Sioux, believed that everything necessary for life could be found in the buffalo. The back of the animal provided the thick skins that the Plains Indians used to make their homes. Other parts of the buffalo hide were made into clothing and warm blankets. The bones were made into tools. No part of the animal was wasted. No one knows how many buffalo were in North America when Meriwether Lewis first met the Shoshone. But experts believe there were probably between 60 million and 75 million. Another animal also played an important part in the Indian cultures of the Great Plains. When Native Americans first saw these animals, they called them big dogs or mystery dogs. They had no word for this kind of animal in their languages. We know it as the horse. The horse had long been extinct in North America.
You have to understand that there were horse species here, you know, millions of years ago, but they died out 10,000 years ago, and so no one had seen a horse.
Until the arrival of Christopher Columbus and other Spanish explorers. Emil Hermeni Horses, curator at the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, describes the at first frightening sight to the Native Americans.
So what comes back with the Spaniards, with Christopher Columbus on his second voyage, are horses as we know them today, the large animals. And so you can understand that people who had never seen these before, then to see a rider on top of it, dressed in armor, it must have looked like this tank coming at you that you did not know what it was. So, of course, it struck fear. The Spaniards, the conquistadors capitalized on that, realizing that it was causing fear and confusion, that they actually put bells on here. So even adding that extra level of noise to frighten the natives who never encountered the horse.
Before the introduction of horses to North America, Indians mostly traveled by foot. Traveling long distances was difficult. So was hunting buffalo. The horse greatly changed life for the tribes of the Great Plains. It gave them a new way to travel and to carry food and equipment. It made it easier and safer for them to follow and hunt the buffalo.
Originally, you may have killed one or two buffalo, where if you're on horseback, you'd be able to kill more buffalo.
The Smithsonian's Emil Hermeni Horses, who is a member of the Oglala Lakota.
And with killing more buffalo, you had more meat, you had more resources to make clothing from the hides, and also to make teepees. So things became more and bigger. So you might see a bigger teepee because you had more hides, you were able to kill more buffalo and process it, and so more abundance.
The horse made it possible to attack an enemy far away and return safely. The measure of a tribe's wealth became the number of horses it owned. Spanish settlers rode horses to the small town of Santa Fe, in what is now the southwestern state of New Mexico. They arrived there in about 1609. How Native Americans got their first horses is not known. Perhaps they traded for them, perhaps they captured them. Soon, many tribes were doing both. By the 1750s, all the tribes of the Great Plains had horses. They had become experts at raising, training, and riding them. And they became experts at horse medicine. Indians of the Great Plains could ride a horse by the age of 5. As an adult, a man would have one horse for work. Another would be specially trained for hunting.
A horse would be trained to ride into the herd. You know, and buffaloes are noted as being, although they're huge in their size, but they can turn very quickly. So a horse had to be ready and then be able to anticipate that. So you did have hunting horses that were trained to ride into a herd of buffalo.
And a third would be trained for war. An Indian warrior's success depended on how closely he and his horse worked together.
You wanted to train this horse. I mean, you were one in battle with the horse. When you went into battle, you were a brother, an ally, a comrade. So the horse was trained to fight in close skirmishes.
George Catlin was an artist who traveled in the early American West. He painted many pictures of the Indians and their horses. Catlin said the Plains Indian was the greatest rider the world had ever known. He said the moment an Indian laid a hand on his horse, he became part of the animal. Both the buffalo and the horse were extremely important to the Plains Indians. Because the horse made hunting easier, more time could be spent on other activities, including art. The Plains Indians began to make designs on their clothing and on blankets for their horses. The arrival of white settlers on the Great Plains marked the beginning of the end
for the horse and buffalo culture of the Indians. Settlers did not want buffalo destroying their crops. Great numbers of buffalo were killed. By 1885, the Indians of the Great Plains were mostly restricted to areas called reservations.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world.